right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have a packed show today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Professor David Lloyd. David is one of the leaders in the whole academic and cultural boycott of Israel. So make sure you stay tuned to that. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show, after a considerable hiatus, Larry Everest. Larry's a writer with Revolution Newspaper, and he's the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't think of anybody else I wanted to talk to besides you in the this insane pile of whatever you want to call it that's being thrown at our faces and burying the world in today. After Obama's speech outlining his plan to degrade and destroy ISIS and do bombing raids into Syria and to send more, you know, efforts into Iraq and just the entire upheaval in the Middle East and the whole idea, that they're pumping out, of course, is who knows what's true, but the press is pumping out ideas that the vast majority of people are finally behind Obama and what he's doing. And he's got, you know, he's following in the footsteps of his most beloved president in relation to foreign policy, George H.W. Bush. Boy, what does that tell you? We're sitting here and we're looking at this. And yet, once again, the entire question of war, instability, and questions that are posed about what's happening to people in the world, why it's happening, and what the hell is the future going to look like. So I couldn't think of anybody I wanted to talk about this more with than you. So let's jump into this, man. What's your read of Obama's speech?
Well, Michael, the more I thought about it, the more outraged I've gotten. I mean, it reminds me of, he's the commander-in-chief of an empire that has turned the Middle East into a living hell for the people there. It reminds me of what Malcolm X said about the United States standing up in front of the world talking about human rights like a bloody-jawed wolf with blood dripping down its fangs. Really, ISIS, yes, reactionary Islamic fundamentalist organization. But what the U.S. has done to that region makes whatever ISIS done pale in comparison. Obama talked about them killing civilians and children. Let's talk about Iraq. I was in Iraq in 1991. The U.S. murdered 500,000 children through sanctions. I videotaped it. It's online. People should see this. During this war, during the invasion of this war, you want to talk about killing innocents and children? The U.S. war, thanks to the U.S. war, over 1 million Iraqis are dead. 4.5 million driven from their homes, millions wounded. What about raping and enslaving women? U.S. Marines in a Haditha raped a teenager and then burned her whole family to cover it up and killed 24 people in the town. The U.S. supports tyrants. Saudi Arabia, you want to talk about enslaving women? What about Afghanistan? What about Pakistan? Any of these countries on a grand scale. And what did the U.S. do in Iraq? They brought in a reactionary Shiite fundamentalist government that passed laws enslaving women. He got up there and said, oh, we can't allow the Yazidis and the Turkmen to be driven from their ancient lands. That is a crime, what's happening to those religious minorities. But meanwhile, what about the Palestinians? They've been driven from their ancient lands, and the U.S. has not only supported it, it's funded it, it's armed it, it's encouraged it, and it's kept encouraging it for over 60 years. And then Obama talks about ISIS has no principle but using force against those standing in their way. And in his very speech, he declared that was only the U.S. had that right, and it could do it all over the world. So the basic thing is the U.S. is just going to go in there and create more mayhem, kill many more people, and it's their actions that have fueled reactionary Islamic fundamentalism, and we could spend hours talking about all the different ways they've done it. And let's get real, Michael. When the U.S. says they're fighting terrorists, what they mean is that they're fighting a particular group that is not yet working. for the United States at that particular moment, but that could change. Mm-hmm. I mean, who are they allied with throughout the region? As a bunch of terrorist regimes or fighters and all these different people they claim they're going to train and arm up? That's the first and foremost. There's a lot of geopolitics, but people should just be outraged about this.
I certainly appreciate that. In fact, I was thinking about that as you were making the comparisons and whatnot. Even the idea that somehow the just terrible opportunistic marshaling of people's hatred for the savage beheading of two journalists. And you think about that, though, even in relation to what you're saying. I read something from Deborah Sweet from World Can't Wait recently that talked about, well, if he was really upset about beheadings and was really going to take some country out or some force out around beheadings, how about Saudi Arabia, which is beheaded maybe 30 people in the last couple of months?
113 in the last 2 years. And where are we reading about that in the newspaper?
Right, exactly. Or maybe Obama and the King of Saudi Arabia are talking about it on the phone, as they said they had these strategic phone calls the other night. But before we get into the next question, let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're talking about Obama's recent speech where he told the world that even though we're in the middle of an extremely dangerous situation in the Middle East overall, and that there's huge things being thrown up in the world, that he is indeed going to bring the world to war once again. But here's the question, Larry. The big question for me is, it's not about the beheadings. It's not about all the things that the U.S. has put out that it's about. There is something very, very important for people to understand about what's concentrated in that region. There is so much bound up with the future of the world, in a certain sense, right there. And it's changing, and there's all these forces in motion, and including the U.S., which is, it's almost like you're looking about it, it's war again, and it's war again, and again, and again. And the whole question of why is this? What's concentrated there? What is driving U.S. imperialism to actually have to jump into this?
Well, in the speech, Obama condemned ISIS warped ideology. Yes, religious fundamentalism is a warped ideology. But meanwhile, he's delivering a speech with an even more warped ideology of American chauvinism and only American lives matter. And this is how he's trying to sell this. Oh, don't worry. It's not a real war. Americans aren't going to get killed. We're just going to be bombing and blowing a bunch of people to smithereens. Don't worry about this. This is a repugnant, just horrific, disgusting ideology that they're trying to train the American people, or people living in this country, I should say, in that. And people need to reject this. If you want to stop this horrible situation of imperialism in the U.S. and Israel and its allies bombing and killing people, and that in turn fueling reactionary fundamentalism, then you need to speak up and act now and say this speech and all this saving American lives nonsense, I reject that. I reject it. American lives aren't any more important than anybody else's lives. That's what I stand for, and I'm protesting this war. People need to do that. And in terms of the warped ideology and the U.S. can do whatever it wants, anywhere it wants, you're totally right, Michael. This is not about beheadings. This is about imperialism. This is about the fact that the U.S. understands that ISIS or ISIL is a strategic threat to their domination of that region. It threatens to fracture the state structure in that region. Look, this is a region imperialism has dominated it for 100 years. We have the 100th anniversary of World War I. What was that war fought for? Partly to divide up the Middle East between France, Russia, and Britain. Of course, Russia got overthrown, and Lenin leaked the Sykes-Picot documents, so now we know exactly what happened there. And after World War II, the U.S. took over. And this is a key part of their global capitalist empire, because it's home to about 60% of the world's energy resources. It's a strategic piece of real estate. You've got the Persian Gulf, flow of oil, the Suez Canal trade route. It's a military crossroads between Asia, Africa, and Europe. Dominating and controlling this region has been very key to the U.S.'s ability to dominate and control the whole world economy and to subordinate all these other powers in the world, including Europe or Japan, even impacting China and Russia, to what the U.S. wants. So this is imperialism, pure and simple. It's naked imperialism. It's backed up by violence. And how has the U.S. maintained this domination? It's maintained this domination by creating a whole network of reactionary tyrants and dictators, military dictators, religious dictators. It's armed Israel to the teeth to be its attack dog in the region. They see this regional order and this control being shaken by this. So whether Obama wants to be there or not, they are compelled to do it. And in his speech, he gave this big rah-rah, yes, we've had a hard time over the last 13 years, but the U.S. is better positioned. No, this is an empire facing deep, profound contradictions here and around the world. And by the way, since we're talking about terrorism, what about the daily terrorism that faces a woman if she wants to have an abortion in this country? What about the daily terrorism facing African-American people or Latinos or people without papers? What about that terrorism? They're inflicting terrorism on people in this ruling class is on people in this country every single day.
Well, Larry, real quick, we have about 2 minutes left. If you had to look at this and say, okay, here's the point that I think people really need to take away from this whole thing, what is it?
Well, I think there are 3 points. Number one, nothing good comes from U.S. imperialism. It's completely illegitimate. It's based on exploitation and oppression. And look, it's proved it over and over and over and over again. Look at the history of the Middle East. Read my book. Read revcom.us. where this is broken down, where my writing is, Alan Goodman's writing, other people. That's point one. Number two, resist. People need to resist this and get out there and not be passive in the face of it. And number three, dig into the deeper reasons for what you were talking about. You said war after war after war. I thought we'd left Iraq. Now the U.S. is back in Iraq. Why is this happening? What are the root causes of it, and what is the root, the solution to this? And again, I recommend people read the analysis at revcom.us, at Revolution Newspaper, and also the solution, the revolutionary solution that is laid out in the paper and on that website. You can connect with the revolution there. So those are the things. And, you know, to stand with the oppressed people in the Middle East for their liberation, not for their enslavement by either reactionary fundamentalism or even more terrifying reactionary imperialism.
All right, Larry, thank you very much for joining us today, and we will have you back, maybe hopefully next week or maybe the week after that, but we will definitely be continuing this discussion. All right, so thanks a lot, man.
Hey, terrific, Michael. Take care.
Okay, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Larry Everest, writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back.
I'm on a war tour with Obama, my man. It never matters where I go, yo, there I am. I'm on a war tour with a gun in my hand, bombing each and every land, cause I'm there I can. This war is never ending, let's stop pretending. This government keeps its troops everywhere it sends them, forever. Never even occupying other lands. Since World War II, they still got troops in Japan, man. And they plan to keep them there for eternity. 65 years later, still got soldiers left in Germany. It's USA, hey, that's how they do ya. Since 1898, there's still a Navy base in Cuba. Guantanamo. Yeah, no matter where we go, they adore us. Cause we always bring McDonald's with us, plus a couple models with us. What's the problem with us? Iraq, Afghan, Libyan, what? Child killing, bomb dropping, tree chopping, huh? Iraq, Afghan, Libyan, what? Child killing, bomb dropping, tree chopping.
All right, welcome back. That was Sunrise Above with Obama. Okay, that's the O-B-O-M-B-A, okay, just to get the spelling right. There you go. And very fitting for the times today, all right? Just last week, we had spent some time talking with Anna Baltzer about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And as we talked about that, we began to hit on a subject that was very important, which was the whole academic and cultural boycott. And recently, I had a chance to speak with David Lloyd, who is one of the big figures in that whole movement. And I'm not going to do any more to introduce this, but here's my discussion with David Lloyd. Okay, so check this out, and I'll be back when it's over. All right, well, you know, after weeks and weeks and weeks of watching the horrific genocidal assault by the Israeli regime, the Zionist regime, on Gaza and the Palestinian people, you know, I've been looking for all kinds of ways to bring out and to interview, to talk with, to sort of bring forward the kinds of movements, the kinds of people that are actually standing with the Palestinian people in times like today. And one of the things that struck me, and if people who were listening last week might recall that we talked with Anna Baltzer, she's very much involved in the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement here in the U.S., and she's also somebody who really pointed me in the direction of pursuing this more, because I wanted to get into what exactly is this whole BDS movement. And in the course of that, I came across the fact that since April of 2004, the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel has called upon intellectuals and academics worldwide to comprehensively and consistently boycott all Israeli academic and cultural institutions as a contribution to the struggle to end Israel's occupation, colonization, and system of apartheid. And in 2006, a decisive majority of Palestinian cultural workers, including most filmmakers and artists, appealed to all international artists and filmmakers of good conscience to join the institutional cultural boycott against Israel. And here to talk with us about all this is Professor David Lloyd. David is a distinguished professor of English at the University of California at Riverside. He also helped found the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. And as a member of the American Studies Association, he helped lead the successful struggle for the ASA to endorse the academic boycott of Israel. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Michael, for having me on. This is an important issue and an important moment to be talking about it.
You've been actively involved in the BDS movement as a whole. In fact, you were, as I said, you were one of the leading people in the American Studies Association and played an important role in the successful struggle to win them over to endorsing the academic boycott of Israel. What exactly is the academic boycott and why is it so important?
Well, first of all, let me clarify, because this is one of the main points of obfuscation that opponents of the boycott use. This is a boycott that's been called for by Palestinian civil society, 170 different organizations ranging from trade unions to churches to mosques to women's groups and so forth, which calls for the boycott of Israeli academic institutions. Now, I stress that because so often the opposition leads by saying, oh, but how can you possibly cut off dialogue with Israeli individuals, some of whom are the most progressive in the country, and so forth and so forth. It's not actually directed at all at Israeli individuals, because as far as the movement is concerned, we will engage in dialogue with individuals. We will not attempt to prevent people from traveling or attending to conferences and so forth insofar as they come as individual scholars and academics. We actually believe in the principle of academic freedom, and that's why we're doing this. We're doing this because Palestinian scholars are denied academic freedom, and indeed Palestinian institutions, as most recently during Israel's invasion of the West Bank under the pretense of looking for three kidnapped children, started by invading campuses on the West Bank, closing them down, using them as internment camps and so forth. So our emphasis is on institutions. Why is it on Israeli academic institutions? It's on the Israeli academic institutions because without a single exception, firstly, none of them, unlike individual scholars, very few of them, but individual Israeli scholars have condemned the occupation or condemned the assault on Gaza, condemned ethnic cleansing. The institutions, without exception, have refused to condemn what has been done in the name of all Israelis, that is, the occupation and dispossession of Palestinians. Secondly, more than that, every single Israeli institution is to varying degrees completely complicit in maintaining and promoting and conducting the occupation. To give you one example, Technion, which is now engaged in joint projects with Cornell University on Long Island, has a deep investment in military technology, including, for example, the D9 bulldozer, which is initially constructed by Caterpillar and then modified by Technion and the Israeli military to demolish Palestinian houses in acts of collective punishment or in the demolishing of Bedouin villages that are in the way of Israeli appropriation of land and so forth. Tel Aviv University reportedly has at least 50 direct research projects being conducted with the military. Other universities are directly involved in the kind of technological research that helps Israeli corporations like Elbit Systems to develop these surveillance and data collection technologies that are used not only to monitor and control Palestinian movement on the West Bank, which is occupied territory, but they're also used here. And I think this is something very important to stress. Companies like Elbit Systems, which is Israeli, or G4S, the British security company that collaborates in the running of Israeli prisons, are also complicit with the control of U.S. citizens within the country and also immigrants on the border, where they actually provide the technology that conducts surveillance along the frontier. So we're talking about a degree of academic institutional involvement, first of all, in the development of the technologies that enable the Israeli occupation and its bombardment of Gaza that we saw most recently to take place on a daily basis. Secondly, of course, the whole system of Israeli higher education, and indeed all education, discriminates systematically and deliberately against Palestinians. Now, this isn't quite the same as the old days of segregation in the South here. This is much more a system of tiny rules and regulations that cumulatively disadvantage Palestinians. So that just to give one example, dormitory accommodation at Haifa University is not really available to Palestinian or Arab Israelis, not because they are explicitly denied the right to live in the dorms, but because preference is already given to people who have served in the Israeli Defense Forces, which cuts out, of course, Palestinian citizens of Israel who do not serve in the armed forces. And one could go on to multiply the examples, but it's deeply integrated into the very structure of Israeli higher education. And until that changes, we feel that a boycott is appropriate, that it targets these institutions and our collaboration with them. So perhaps the best way to put it is just as in a strike, you withdraw your labor. Our way of putting it is we are withdrawing our consent from our own institutions collaborating with Israeli institutions until the end of the occupation, until the honoring of the rights of refugees to return to their homes, and until the ending of the siege of Gaza. Plus, and it's very important to stress this, until all citizens of Israel gain equal rights in the law and in the political system, because currently Palestinians do not have equal rights by any construction within Israel.
You know, it's interesting because to hear you talk about this, one would think that's pretty reasonable. But there's so much at stake here because even when I was reading about the complicity between the universities and the military in Israel, and the complicity with major weapons makers, like you were saying, and security apparatus, even including the drones that the U.S. is using in many parts of the world to carry out murder from on high, you know, were developed by an Israeli corporation and the Israeli universities and whatnot, the research that was done there. I know that the Israeli universities are also kept very clean. I interviewed Ilan Pape a while back and a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about how difficult it was to be an academic in Israel and speak the truth about what's going on. So you want to talk about the importance of dialogue and discourse and wrestling with these concepts to have a better world. Actually, that very much itself is squashed. So they also contribute to a certain broad opinion in society and squashing, you know, truth in the purpose of in service to dehumanizing the Palestinian people to a very large degree.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, just look what happened to the professor at Bar-Ilan University during the last Israeli assault on Gaza. He merely sent a notice to his incoming class in which he expressed sympathy for the dead in Gaza. And he was roundly reprimanded, not by the press, but by his own administration. And this has happened over and over again, as we've seen. What I don't want to omit stressing, however, is that every time this issue comes up for discussion, we seem to get locked into thinking about Israel and Israeli institutions and the effect on Israeli institutions. And indeed, as you just alluded to, as Naomi Klein says, you know, Israel is the laboratory for the surveillance state that affects all of us, and that's for sure. But what constantly gets erased is the impact of the Israeli occupation on Palestinian scholars. Nobody is standing up, at least not outside the movement for academic boycott, saying it is wrong that Palestinians should be denied academic freedom. And they're being denied their academic freedom from primary school on up on an absolutely daily basis, ranging from the checkpoints on the West Bank that prevent kids from getting to school and doing their exams to the frequent closures. We saw one, as I just said, on the West Bank in June on a trumped-up excuse, to the fact that scholars in Gaza are not allowed to travel to the West Bank to continue their education in courses that are not available to them in Gaza. They've been denied the right even to take up Fulbright scholarships to come and study in the USA, which you would have thought would be just fundamental if you're trying to engage with Palestinian civil society. So in multiple ways, Palestinians are on an absolutely daily basis denied their academic freedom. And we don't hear a peep out of our congresspeople or out of our presidents of universities who are all too ready to condemn the American Studies Association for introducing a boycott. We didn't hear a peep out of them when Palestinians in this country and in Palestine itself are being denied their rights.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with David Lloyd. David is a distinguished professor of English at the University of California at Riverside. He helped found the U.S. campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel and led in bringing the American Studies Association to the point of actually successfully passing a boycott of Israeli universities and the academic exchanges that they'd like to talk about. Tell me this, David. Here's something that really keeps hitting me back hard. It's sort of, you know, we talk about this, and I think it's very important that people don't know about what you've been speaking about the assault on Palestinian academia. They don't know about the complicity of the Israeli academia and the government. They also don't know, when it is taken up here, that it's very contentious. Why do you think it's so contentious, and how does that manifest itself out there in terms of the price that people are often forced to pay if they do step forward to take this up?
Well, it's interesting, Michael. Your audience may or may not know. There's been a case of this just recently. The University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign suddenly denied a position to a Palestinian American whom they had hired with great accolades. They'd announced it. They had congratulated him on the appointment and started scheduling his classes. When suddenly, on the basis of some tweets he did, angry tweets, it must be said, but rightly angry, about the brutal Israeli assault on Gaza that killed 500 children and more, as well as, you know, 1,500 adults. On the basis of those tweets, he was accused by the chancellor in a rather duplicitous statement of incivility. And she said, you know, one thing we will protect our students from is the problem of incivility. Not mentioning, of course, that what turned out and what we all suspected from the start was that the real reason was that she had received pressure from pro-Zionist donors who had said they would withdraw their funding that they were intending to give to the university if Stephen Salida was hired. Now, this question of civility is really interesting. Every single person I know that has been publicly involved in the boycott campaign has been subject to the most abusive emails, letters, telephone calls, so forth and so forth, all of which are not just incivil, but actually involve death threats. They involve threats to one's employment and so forth. And the case of Stephen Salida is unfortunate and typical in that his very existence as a professor was not only threatened, but actually denied to him, with the most infamously defaming language being used in the process. Now, of course, we shouldn't be entirely surprised by this. Institutions of higher education in this country increasingly are in hock to philanthropic so-called donors who like to control then the program of the university and to shape it the way they want. And that is inevitably going to be a right-wing way to shape it. Secondly, we are effectively in a war. Israel does not think of the academic boycott as a matter for debate. It does not think of it as something we could discuss civilly around the table. It wants to crush it. It has actually, apparently, declared that the academic and cultural boycott is the second largest existential threat to Israel after a nuclear Iran, if you can imagine this. Now, that sounds preposterous, and I see you laughing. But actually, when you think about it, they are not entirely wrong. When we were engaged in the divestment movement against South African apartheid back in the 80s, we really did focus a lot of our attention on the cultural and sports boycott. Now, clearly, South Africa did not collapse because of the cultural and sports boycott. It collapsed partly because of the economic boycott and, of course, because of, you know, Cuba's defeat of the South African army in Angola. But that aside, the huge contribution that was made by the sports and cultural boycott to shifting public opinion in South Africa to the point where South Africa could give in to the anti-apartheid movement without violence, without it having to come to crisis point of violence, was because countries like South Africa and Israel, which are fundamentally racist states, believe themselves nonetheless to be part of and integrated in the Western democratic sphere. And one of the ways that they justify themselves and believe themselves to be legitimately part of that sphere is through things like culture and sports. And that was the main thing in the South African case. The South Africans could go play rugby in New Zealand or in England and so forth. In the Israeli case, it's actually primarily through culture and higher education that they feel that they are prestigiously linked to the Western sphere of states and democracies and so forth. To target those things is to target the very point at which Israeli society feels most legitimate and most proud of itself. You'll see constantly these incredibly racist advertisements where they talk about the number of Israelis who have won Nobel Prizes, and then they attack the Arabs by saying Arabs have never won a Nobel Prize. You wonder how many different ways the racism in that statement runs. But it is very, very much an issue of prestige. So that what we are trying to do is not to suffer from the delusion that we can close down overnight Israeli academic institutions, but to make the point that the collaboration and cooperation with Israeli institutions of higher education is a process of trying to normalize a situation that is in different but in equally dire ways an apartheid state. There's nothing odd about saying that Israel is an apartheid state. The very moment they start to say this is a Jewish state for Jewish people, they have declared themselves to be an apartheid state in which there is only possible second-class citizenship for Palestinians. And we can go into the details. But
not to mention, I mean, if you want to talk about the origin myths of, you know, South Africa and Israel, very, very similar in terms of, well, it was a land without people for a people without land. But I wanted to get back a little bit on this question of what happens to the people who advocate for the boycott. From the Students for Justice in Palestine, who have been attacked, assaulted, you know, I mean, hunted down almost and driven out of the schools or attempted to be driven out of the schools in certain places, to the professors. Like you talked about Stephen Salaita. There's also William Robinson, who was, you know, targeted. We had him on the show a couple weeks ago. Then you have, in addition to that, even outside of the academic realm, you have all these state legislators passing these laws that are just these draconian, bring the hammer down on anybody who tries to get behind the academic boycott in particular.
Well, what's especially dangerous about this is that it starts with a few pro-Palestinian activists. And what we see is, for example, the New York State Legislature attempting to put in a measure that would ban boycotts. Now, the obvious reason they're doing this is that it targets Israel, but then it extends to boycotts of other things. So that it is a move towards depriving progressives of the means that we have traditionally used to exercise some kind of power in civil society. By the same token, this recent case with Professor Stephen Salaita at Urbana-Champaign flew in the face of norms of academic freedom and faculty governance. The trustees have affirmed that the chancellor had the right to ignore what her faculty had advised, what they had deliberated over for an extensive period in reviewing Stephen Salaita's case. And in affirming that arrogation to herself of the power to override her faculty, the trustees have actually instituted and tested out, if you like, it's another laboratory situation, they have tested out an overriding of faculty freedoms and student freedoms. The right also of students to hear controversial views has been overridden in this case. They have done that in a way which will act as a model for the same sorts of things happening elsewhere, and not only in the case of Palestinian activists, but in all kinds of ways in which faculty dissent from the norms that the universities increasingly are seeking to uphold. Anybody who dissents will now feel vulnerable to the possibility that the university will take arbitrary measures against them. It is in very real ways, the phrase has been used, it's in very real ways a McCarthyite situation where people are being hunted down for their dissenting views and then blacklisted, effectively.
We're talking today with David Lloyd, a distinguished professor of English at the University of California at Riverside, and also is one of the co-founders of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. Now, David, there's also the cultural boycott, which itself, it's similar, but it's also got a little bit of a difference in it. What is the cultural boycott? What does it entail? And how's it been going?
Well, you probably remember the song Ain't Gonna Play Sun City that was big in the 80s. Yeah. Like with the South African cultural boycott, as I've already said, what the cultural boycott is targeting is the normalization of Israeli society that is broadcast every time a popular band or a theater company or a dance troupe goes over to Israel. It says, you are one of us, you are among us, and we find your society normal to the extent that we want to participate in your cultural institutions and so forth. So what the cultural boycott asks is for artists to recognize that this is not a normal situation. This is a state that is founded on the eviction and dispossession of Palestinians, that maintains an occupation and a siege which have been murderous in their implications. It's not just that 2,000 people were killed in Gaza in a brief one-month assault, but also that on a daily basis, Palestinians are literally killed, but also that their society and their culture is being killed. So once again, we constantly get locked into what is the impact of this on Israeli culture, and is it fair to damage Israeli cultural institutions, which are often progressive, et cetera, and what falls out of the picture is the impact on Palestinian cultural institutions. Part of Israel's project has been, since its inception, to try to destroy Palestinian memory. And the bearer of Palestinian memory is its culture. Now, of course, the Palestinians have an extraordinary capacity to resist, and it's one of the things that in doing this work you really learn from. Palestinians have really developed an extraordinary capacity not only to resist military assault and violent occupation, but also to resist this desire to erase their existence as a people, which they're constantly told, there is no Palestinian people. So it's not merely that one is saying, let us withdraw our consent until Israel recognizes the full panoply of rights of the Palestinians to self-determination and to access to the full society. Let us withdraw our consent from performing Israel. Let's not play Sun City, whether it's Haifa or Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, wherever. And it's hard because in some ways it's easier for an academic like myself. We have certain protections, vulnerable as they are increasingly becoming, whereas individual artists really are subject to the blackmail of their producers, the blackmail of their record companies or their theater companies or whatever, and can be very powerfully coerced into falling into line and not engaging in a boycott, whether of Israel or anywhere else. But, you know, there have always been really courageous artists. Perhaps the most prominent of them at the moment in regard to the cultural boycott of Israel is Roger Waters, who has been steadfast in his refusal. Also Ken Loach, the great left-wing British filmmaker. Elvis Costello has refused to go. There's been a whole range of artists who have refused to go. Sometimes they use covers like saying, you know, they had terrorist threats and so forth about going. But generally speaking, they have been willing to speak out and say, no, I will not participate. I will not consent to normalizing what is a deeply abnormal and unjust situation.
And there's other people. I mean, there's people like Alice Walker, who is
absolutely
really outstanding,
yes,
in her support,
yes,
for the Palestinian, mm-hmm, people. I have a list here that includes Bjork, Jean-Luc Godard, and then Snoop Dogg, okay?
Snoop Dogg,
which,
yes.
You know, and I know that there's a story behind that, where mm-hmm, I had one of the first people I interviewed when I first started doing radio was Fred Reck, who's a producer, a hip-hop producer, and he's out here in L.A., and he was very big in the whole Snoop Dogg crowd and Dre crowd, and he's Palestinian. And at one point, he took a whole bunch of these hip-hop heads from L.A. and around the country and brought them to Palestine. And he said he wanted to help them understand that the situation of black people in America is very similar to the situation of Palestinian people under Zionist rule. These kinds of things don't get propagated very broadly. You have to really look to get into this. And one of the things that happens, I know I was talking to you earlier, and I told you about a lot of some friends of mine who they would go to Israel and they would say, people get hit with something on what's supposed to be a higher moral ground, which is they say, you know, if you don't come, you're actually being anti-Semitic. And that, I think, gets a lot of people confused and you know, they say, to hell with it, I'm going to do this because I don't want to, you know, I may not agree with what they're doing, but I'm not anti-Semitic either.
Well, this is a very, very familiar charge to anybody who's been working, whether it's academic or cultural boycott. And it's basically a smokescreen. I don't doubt for a second that anti-Semitism continues to exist. However, to criticize a nation state for its policies, particularly when those policies are explicitly and in their own terms racial policies, is not to be against the people that that state claims to represent. Now, in fact, I would say that the most racist thing is to say that all Jews must be identified with the state of Israel, and that Israel is their legitimate representative in all cases, and that therefore to attack the state of Israel in any way is to be against all Jews, because that basically says that all Jews have to fall into line and have a single political representative and a single political set of views. As it happens, and as you know from interviewing Ilan Pappe or Anna Balser, in the movement that is calling for the boycott, there are probably more Jewish people working than of any other ethnicity except Palestinians. I don't like to harp on that because it shouldn't be about whether you are Jewish or Palestinian. It should be about whether you believe in justice or not. And that's, I think, why so many Jews are involved in it. They are simply people who believe in justice for all and who take the slogan that says never again about the Holocaust and say that it means never again for anybody. Now, what actually the constant hammering on this theme of the boycott is anti-Semitic is actually designed to do is to take attention off the real racism that's involved. There are over 50 individual laws on the Israeli books that discriminate against Palestinians. They range from the citizenship law that denies family unification, so that if you're a Palestinian and you marry someone from the West Bank, your spouse is not allowed to come live with you in Israel. They involve all kinds of discriminatory practices that have to do with everything from the endowing of a right of return on all Jews, whether they ever inhabited Palestine or not, and its denial to Palestinians who were evicted by force from their homes, not only in 1948, but also subsequently they're being evicted from East Jerusalem as we speak. They're being evicted from the West Bank and sent to Gaza in some cases if charges are brought against them. One can go on. 95% or more of the land of Israel is reserved for Jewish people. I can multiply these examples indefinitely. But the fact is that Israel is, in different ways from South Africa, by the definition of the United Nations and the Rome Statute on racism, an apartheid state. We don't have to say it's exactly like South Africa. The law is not, it has to look like South Africa to be apartheid. The law is if a state systematically discriminates against one racial or ethnic group in order to secure the advantage of the other, it is an apartheid state. That's a brief paraphrase of the law, but that's what it is. So the hammering on this question of anti-Semitism is really yet again a smokescreen to actually disguise what the situation is for Palestinians on the ground.
Let's talk about this first, although I'll repeat again because I'm getting so involved in the conversation. I don't want to forget to let people know that we're talking with Professor David Lloyd from the UC Riverside, and we're talking about the academic and cultural boycott of Israel. Now, David, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, just off of what you were just saying, there's so much wool pulled over so many people's eyes in relation to this. I mean, it's like you get all kinds of ideas about, as we were saying, that, well, it's anti-Semitic, it's this, it's that. And they try to play on morality to a certain extent. And I was just thinking recently, I saw an ad that was in the LA Times, and I understand it also appeared in Billboard magazine, maybe a few other publications, and it was one that was put out by a group called the Creative Community for Peace. And it started out saying, look, you know, we're creative artists, we're all about art, and it's serving as a bridge to peace in between Israel and Palestine, and we really care about what's going on, and we hate the war and all the stuff, the suffering of people. However, we also are against the fascistic, murderous ideology of Hamas. And then they go on and they detail, word for word, every heinous lie that the Zionist regime put out in relation to why they went into Gaza, what they were doing in Gaza, from the children being used as human shields to the hospitals being used to store weaponry. All of this was repeated, and there were 200 people that signed it. And progressive people, Ziggy Marley, Sarah Silverman, Roseanne Barr, you know, and they're in the midst of all these other people that you're not that surprised about. But there is this thing that constantly gets brought up here in terms of the hiding of all this. And, you know, here's the interesting thing, and this is sort of what I wanted to talk about as well. There were a couple of major articles in significant newspapers in the country about this ad. None of them ever mentioned the fact that what one small reporter mentioned who wrote a short little article saying, well, who is this group? And found out there were links with this group called Stand With Us and this one of the more fascistic organizations in, you know, connected up with Israel and all this other stuff, total support for the settlements. None of them ever bothered to look at the dubious claims in this thing and who were these people. And then you have, I wanted to ask you about the complicity of the U.S. on that level, you know, in terms of the press and whatnot, but also the government here, because as I said, the government, there's a certain amount of complicity here. And even when you see the head of the university that you work for, the university system, who used to be the head of Homeland Security, who, you know, was drawn into a minor tussle over the question of a student at UCLA saying people who are in the student government should not accept prepaid trips to Israel by these organizations that actually have a political agenda. And, you know, you're seeing this, and there's a complicity of the American universities in this. While they're saying, we don't want to step on toes and squash this, at the same time, they're squashing, you know, they're attacking the people that are standing up and doing this, as you were talking about with Stephen Salaita and William Robinson and other people. But there's also the general government and the press and the whole atmosphere that gets created around this. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing I'd want to say is that the reason for BDS is that the political process is completely locked up as far as Israel is concerned. I mean, during the 2009 Operation Cast Lead, for example, only four congresspeople or senators were willing to come out against a House resolution that was utterly mendacious from start to finish. I mean, that basically accused Hamas of starting the conflict when it was well documented even in U.S. papers that it was Israel who had actually provoked the conflict and ended the ceasefire and so forth. Really, we'll see that the same is exactly true of the more recent assault on Gaza. And there was a similar House resolution at that time as well that our own senators, Barbara Boxer actually sponsored and initiated. And it was equally mendacious. Now, all that means is that we don't expect presidents of universities and congresspeople or people in the White House to be for justice. I mean, that would be naive. They never have been. The president of the UC system was against divestment, against South Africa, right to the end. And only the pressure of civil society pushed the regents to signing on to divestment from South Africa. So that wherever the political process is blocked to ordinary people who believe in justice, what you need to do is produce a civil society movement. And that's what the Palestinians have done. This has not been called for by Hamas. This has not been called for especially by the Palestinian Authority. Certain Fatah groups are part of the 170s civil society movements that are involved, and possibly Hamas organizations are too, but they are not the leaders. And indeed, one thing I'd want to stress is that my own commitment to nonviolence is not merely because I don't believe in killing people on the way, you know, to a better world, but also because nonviolent movements tend to be less dependent on leaders. And that's really crucial. They're not dependent on having a leader tell them where to go and what to do. So that it's a very decentralized movement. It's a grassroots movement. There's SJP involved. There's Jewish Voice for Peace involved. There's US ACP, obviously, very much involved, as I am with that. It's coming up often from places that nobody had ever heard of. It's a grassroots movement whose strength is that it really doesn't matter what presidents of universities or congresspeople say as they conduct really what is a very brutal and coercive attempt to suppress dissent on their campuses. Doesn't matter, because this is going to spread in the grassroots. It's not ever been intended to spread at the level of Congress. They'll follow. They'll come along eventually, because I was part of the South Africa divestment movement. It looked pretty grim at certain points, and we won. I've been part of the movement for justice in Northern Ireland, and eventually, though it looked pretty grim, we won. I was part of working for the liberation of East Timor. It looked really desperate, and eventually we won. And in every single case, we've won because people have moved for justice and not because politicians have led the way. And I think that's what's happening here, too.
Okay, David, and while I'll disagree with you around the need for leadership, that's something we can talk about later. But I do have one last question. As I was preparing for this, I came across something that really was kind of very inspiring. It was Stephen Hawking. Yeah. And Stephen Hawking refusing to go to Israel. And when they tried to, you know, they said, oh, it was because of his health and whatnot. And he didn't sit back and say, okay, yeah, I'll let them say that. He stepped forward and said, no, if I went, I would have criticized what they're doing to the Palestinian people. And I thought about the Stephen Hawking question, because last week when I talked with Anna Baltzer, she made the point that this academic and cultural boycott is really the Achilles heel for the Zionist regime for Israel. And I wanted to ask you about that. Both, what do you think of that in terms of this? And again, it comes back to what we were talking about earlier about the legitimacy question, because this really is something that strikes hard. And when you get Stephen Hawking saying, you know, and the Israelis went crazy over this. They just went nuts, more than anybody else that had ever stepped out like that. And a part of it, because he seemed to cross a lot of different worlds, and he's somebody of great moral authority in the world, and he was saying this, and that Achilles heel. And I wanted to ask you about what you thought about that in relation to legitimacy, and also, wrapping it up, where do you think it's going to go now in the wake of Gaza?
Well, first of all, I mean, Anna Baltzer has been a really great worker in this campaign, and I admire her enormously, and I agree with her in this instance. The academic and cultural boycott is the Achilles heel. The reason is, it's all very easy for the Israelis to conduct a military campaign using the kind of nonsensical language about Hamas fascists that they used in the advertisement you just cited. Because, for one thing, it's easy to blow things up. And then, of course, in a moment of crisis like that, you get Obama coming out and saying you have the right to self-defense, even though it's not a self-defense at all. However, when what you have to do is answer to rational and civil, to use that term, arguments that show in detail and with evidence why Israel is a racial state and why its injustice to the Palestinians is intrinsic to that state and not just an accident produced by their need for security, they have no answers. So what we're trying to do through this nonviolent movement is open public discussion on an issue that has been deliberately suppressed and not covered and distorted by our mainstream press and by our politicians and even in our classrooms to a very large extent, and to open it to the air of publicity. And that, of course, produces vulnerability in Israel, because if people begin to see what it is that the U.S. government is subsidizing to the tune of at least $3 billion a year, and that's just the direct funding, that's not the indirect funding like passing weapons to the IDF during Gaza, when people begin to see what exactly it is that we are lending our support to, an apartheid state as vicious in most ways, and possibly, as Noam Chomsky said in The Nation the other day, more vicious than South African apartheid, and with a far more programmatic desire to exterminate the Palestinian people over the long run, it's a slow, creeping genocide, as Ilan Pappe says, once people begin to realize that that's what we're supporting, then they're going to begin to withdraw their support for Israel. And it's happening. And when you ask where things are going, I think that the enormous response to Gaza, globally as well as in the United States, the revulsion at what was happening, and in a minor way, I mean, it's a big issue in some respects, but in the larger scheme of things, minor, the case of Stephen Saleta, that nearly 19,000 people should have signed a petition on his behalf, that 3,000 academics should have said, we will not go to the University of Illinois if this holds, is a real shift in public opinion. And I've been feeling it since 2009 when we made the call within the United States for the boycott. Things have really shifted. And now in response to Gaza, people are saying, well, what can we do? And the answer is immediate, BDS, boycott, divestments, and sanctions. That was not the case 5 years ago. So I would say, you know, we are slowly but quite steadily winning the ground of public opinion on this. And I see, you know, another year of probably more academic institutions engaging in the boycott, more SJP divestment motions, more Presbyterian church-style divestment motions, and so forth. That's what I would say is coming.
All right, David Lloyd, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's been a pleasure to be on your show.
And let's stay in touch, man.
Will do.
All right, welcome back. That was a discussion I had with Professor David Lloyd. David's a distinguished professor of English at UC Riverside, and he is one of the co-founders of the entire academic and cultural boycott of Israel here in the U.S. He's a very courageous and very important person to keep up with in terms of what he's doing, what that group is doing. Very important for people to take a stand. That's sort of the idea of the entire program today, is we need to actually lift our heads up and take a stand, all right? But I also want to remind people about next weekend, the 21st, and what's scheduled. Important. You live on a planet. The planet's being destroyed by the same damn capitalist system that's destroying everything else in human life and all kinds of life. And it's destroying this planet, as I said. And people are going to be out in the streets. You need to pay attention to that and figure out what you're going to do in relation to that. All right. And since we're talking about the environment, there's something I want to read to you from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, USA. And it's taken from his book, Basics. And it's in the first chapter, the 29th quotation in there. All right. So it reads like this. This system and those who rule over it are not capable of carrying out economic development to meet the needs of the people now, while balancing that with the needs of future generations and requirements of safeguarding the environment. They care nothing for the rich diversity of the earth and its species, for the treasures this contains, except when and where they can turn this into profit for themselves. These people are not fit to be the caretakers of the earth. Once again, that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it's from his book, Basics, Chapter 1, Quotation 29. And check this out. On November 15th, there is going to be a world historic dialogue between Bob Avakian and Dr. Cornel West. And it's going to be in New York City on November 15th at Riverside Church. And the title of that dialogue is Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, live and in person. You want to find out more information about this? Go to revcom.us. And if you go to revcom.us, you can also find out a lot of information about the entire movement for revolution that is led by Bob Avakian. All right? So check that all out. All right. I want to thank my guests for today, Larry Everest and Professor David Lloyd. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can do so on Twitter and Facebook. And do it. I want to see a whole wild swamp of people rushing to follow me on those two things this time out, all right? It's very exciting to see those numbers grow. All right, we're going to go out now with a song that's appropriate for sort of, well, it's appropriate for the whole show, but I was particularly thinking of Obama. And the song is International War Criminals from the Slackers. Check this out. Talk to you again next week.
Just being human, it's old as original sin, that white.